Good afternoon. This is Dr. John Pinero, and you're tuned in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. Today on our show, our guest is Trent Horn. Many of you are going to be familiar with Trent from his work with Catholic Answers. Mr. Horn converted to Catholicism at the age of 17. Wow, 17. I wish I had come back to the faith that early. Trent has had a passion since then for explaining and defending the faith. He holds degrees from Arizona State University as well as Franciscan University of Steubenville. He has toured the country training pro-life advocates on college campuses and ways to engage in respectful but effective dialogue with their opponents. And as a professor at a Catholic college, I can tell you that that kind of training is just an absolute necessity in our culture. In 2012, he joined Catholic Answers as a speaker and staff apologist. He has authored a book known called Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity. And his brand new book is Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue. That's published by Catholic Answers Press. Trent, welcome to Faith and Reason.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. It really is. I guess I'm curious, before we get into our main topic today, which are the issues you bring up in your book and this idea of dialogue and respectful dialogue, which, as I said, is something that we talk about it a lot at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids where I teach, and sometimes we do it and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we attempt and fail, so I think that's very helpful for, I would say, even faculty and students, but obviously for everyone. Now, before we do that, though, I'm curious about your conversion story. Would you mind sharing a little bit of that with us?
Sure. Well, my parents, my father's Jewish and my mother is not a practicing Catholic. She doesn't go to Mass anymore. She left the church a long time ago. So myself, my siblings, we were really raised without religion, maybe like Christian undertones, but we were kind of free to pick whatever we wanted. And in the beginning of high school, I was just kind of a deist. I believed there was a God who was out there, but he didn't really care about me very much. But then after I came to know some of my peers who were in a Catholic youth group at my high school, I started going to Mass with them, and I decided to do some investigating, and I came to the conclusion first that Christianity was true. And then searching of all the churches to join, I felt that the Catholic Church actually was the church that Christ founded. And then I made my decision when I was a junior in high school to be received into the church. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've done youth ministry, and I've also done a lot of pro-life speaking. That was also a passion of mine early on. And that really has culminated now after years of training and speaking on the issue to writing this book that I hope will equip other people when they have these conversations.
How developed were your views on life and the pro-life issue prior to your conversion? I'm always curious if these come along with the conversion afterwards. I'm sure, of course, they develop afterward.
Well, interestingly enough, I knew at that time that abortion was bad. I mean, I wouldn't have been considered pro-life or anything like that. I would have been like many who thought that, oh, this is bad, but there's nothing I should do about it. Even if I think it should be illegal, it's just not an issue I was as concerned with. And after my conversion, the issue came up more, especially when it visited my campus. I realized it visited my campus in the form of a photo exhibit sponsored by a group called Justice for All, that had pictures of the unborn before and after abortion. And through those activities, I was able to dialogue with pro-choice students, and people saw that I had a kind of a knack for talking to people and for engaging these arguments head-on in a persuasive and gracious way. And so before my conversion, I knew abortion was bad, but after my conversion, I really felt that calling to actually do something about it.
Okay, now, so would you say for Catholics who are uncomfortable in argumentation or in dialogue, or are all Catholics called to, we're all called to defend life, but aren't we all called in different ways to do that? I mean, not everybody's going to be blessed with your talents.
Well, I think we are called in different ways, for sure. Some people will maybe go out and be public speakers or debate the issue or create videos or writings. And other people may help on the more practical end of helping on the pastoral outreach for those maybe who are contemplating abortion or just for praying for an end to abortion. Though I do believe, though, that we all have a responsibility, as 1 Peter 3:15 says, to give a reason for the hope that's within us. And so I think all Catholics have a responsibility to at least know that abortion is wrong and be able to explain at a basic level to someone else, this is why I think that and why it's reasonable. They don't have to be expert debaters or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when the opportunity comes up to defend and stand up for the unborn, I think they should really take that. There are many lives who are counting on them.
How do you account for, if exit polls are to be believed, and they're fairly accurate within reason, I think, how do you account for the large Catholic vote for pro-choice candidates for office, including president?
Yeah, I think the problem there is, one, that the issue of abortion is abstracted into an issue of just choice. And it's not even really about abortion for many people. They understand that abortion is bad, but choice is good. And so people should have the choice even to do bad things. And they don't think of abortion as the actual killing of a human being who has the same value as a toddler. They might think of abortion as being, you know, tragic, as if you had to euthanize an animal. So I think one problem there is that the unborn have been dehumanized, even among many Catholics. They think that the opposition to abortion, it's just a religious opposition. There's not good secular reasons to think that this is a grave injustice. And the other issue I think that comes up is, yeah, thinking that it's a respectable position to be pro-choice. It's tolerant. It's open-minded. So I should just support candidates to have this view. But really, I'd like to think of it as this, that I could no more vote for a candidate that believed the unborn were not persons than I could vote for a candidate who believed that President Obama is not a person because of his skin color. If a candidate thinks a certain group of Americans, the unborn, are not persons, I just don't see how one could vote for them. But you find people look at the issue as more of an issue about abortion, privacy, and choice, and not an issue about human life and rights. And if they did, I think that would change their outlook on the subject.
So we do live in a culture, I think, that increasingly, but there was always a bit of this in American culture. I'm a history professor, I should point out. Trent, you might not know that. And so, you know, I always draw a lot of analogies from history, and it's, you don't have to go too far back in American history, but you can go back to the beginning, and there's always been this debate about rights and obligations, two sides of the same coin, and how do we balance that in society. But there's also been this other thing that I would just call worshiping of freedom for freedom's sake. And we're a culture that just loves choice in everything, whether it's a fast food or the market or getting on the internet and being able to buy whatever we want from our own chair in the privacy of our own home, which is what I was doing last night. It was much easier than standing in line at the store. But so when you call, as you do in the subtitle of your book, abortion our culture's toughest issue, I mean, underlying that is this issue of what freedom is. And I wonder if you might speak to that a bit. When you say abortion is our culture's toughest issue, is this rooted somehow in a misunderstanding of freedom, or do you see this differently?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most common and strangest and, I'll be frank, weakest arguments I hear in defense of legal abortion is people will tell me, well, it's a woman's choice. And I'll just say to them, well, that's not an argument. You're just restating your assertion that you think abortion should be legal. It's the idea that if something is a choice a person can make, then they should have the freedom to make that choice, and then we can't make it illegal or gainsay it. And you're right, there's this mistaken view of freedom in America, that freedom is a good thing, but freedom, properly defined, is the ability to choose the good, not the ability to do whatever you think might be good, because some people, you know, think it might be good to hurt other people, and we clearly restrict their freedom in that regard. I remember reading a poll that was conducted about a year or two ago on Roe versus Wade, and it asked a group of young people, do you think Roe versus Wade should be overturned? And I think about 70% said no, it shouldn't. But in that same poll, 40% of the respondents didn't even know what Roe versus Wade was.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is they just heard, oh, someone wants to restrict people or say they can't do something. Well, I'm against that. I want to err on the side of freedom instead of the side of anything else. And you're right that freedom can become a very dangerous tool, especially when it's used against those like the unborn who can't defend themselves.
The great value I've seen, and just having finished your book, Persuasive Pro-Life, is not only speaking to freedom, but also, although I think this is explicit and implicit in the different kinds of arguments you make in your book, and that is a concern for truth. And so I think also our culture has a great difficulty in discerning truth or in being willing to say, hey, this is true and I know it, or even in reveling and celebrating. I tell my students to celebrate when they've been corrected because now they know something that's true. And they didn't know it 5 minutes ago, but they now know more truth than they did a few minutes ago. And so, but we often get defensive instead when we're backed up against a wall. And as you said, in an argument, we come up with assertions rather than trying to arrive at the truth. And so we have the freedom on the one hand and the truth on the other. And the truth of the unborn, as you intimated a bit ago, this involves science as well as religion. Maybe we can start with the science part. I think you used the word secular. But it seems rather obvious that merely asserting that the child in the womb is not human, once you've seen sonograms and babies being born and ultrasounds and you read at least two pages of Aristotle, and he explains quite clearly that like begets like, and humans don't come from acorns, they come from somewhere. So what is that in the womb?
Right.
That's a scientific fact. If you can't convince somebody of that, what hope do you have for the ethical dimension?
Yeah, I think what's difficult is many people don't understand human development. And so they have this erroneous view that it's just nebulous and we can't know when the life of an individual human being begins. When does sperm and egg cease and a new human being begins? Or they think of it in philosophical terms. But as I put forward in my book, we can know this with a high degree of certainty. I mean, the unborn are growing, so they must be alive. They have human parents and human DNA. And from conception onwards, they're not merely body parts that interact for a larger host. They're their own body that grows and develops. And like you and I, if they're given time, nutrition, and the proper environment, they will continue to grow and develop until their life is cut short, tragically. And so, it's pretty clear. And in my book, I also cite numerous authorities in the field of embryology, which is the study of human embryos, as well as people who are adamant defenders of legal abortion. For example, in my book, I quote David Boonin, who is a philosopher at CU Boulder. He's written probably the most thorough and sophisticated defense of legal abortion, a book called A Defense of Abortion. And even in that book, he says that it's a simple relation between you and me on the one hand and every fetus on the other. All are individual human beings. So the science is very clear. We're dealing with human beings in the womb. The question now is a philosophical one. Do these human beings have the same rights and dignity that you and I possess?
Now, when you encounter people who are not like the author you just mentioned, though, so you must encounter many people who just talk about, they'll use terms like viability, yeah, and other things to diminish the personhood of the unborn. Is that more common? That must be more common than people who say, I acknowledge that that's a human being, but for my convenience, I would like to kill him or her.
Yeah, I think it's a bit more common. Now, I think what they'll say is, yes, biologically it's a human being, that it has human DNA and it's growing and developing. But there's a difference between this human and all of us that makes them not as valuable. Hence, they go after that personhood element. And they might bring up, for example, as you said, viability. Well, the unborn cannot survive outside of the womb, and viability is an essential property of being a person. If you're not viable, you're not a person. But I think that's just very wrong-headed. How does where you're able to survive change whether you are a person or not? How does where you live change the kind of being you are? And so I counsel in the book that when you come across these kinds of objections, just to ask questions. Say, okay, what is a person? Why does viability matter? If we took a premature baby in an incubator, we'd agree they're a person, you can't kill them. But if you put them back into the uterus to continue their gestation, would they suddenly become a non-person again? It just becomes very nonsensical. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the pro-life view of personhood, which is that humans belong to a very special kind, the rational kind, and that kind has rights and intrinsic value, then all the members of that kind, from conception to natural death, have those rights and should be protected, which would mean that abortion should be illegal because it directly kills the unborn.
You spend a lot of time in your book talking about terminology and how important terms are. And I've very loosely thrown out terms today like pro-choice, which is a term actually I hardly ever use that to describe people who favor abortion. But maybe we could spend a few minutes on the importance of using the right terms. If what we want to do is convince our opponent that that the unborn are people and that their life, they deserve life like everybody else. If we want to convince people of that, we have to have our terms right, don't we? Maybe you could spend a minute or two talking about the importance of using the right terms and maybe the big pitfalls to avoid that even well-meaning pro-life advocates fall into.
Yeah, I think it's important. I use the term, in the book, I use the term pro-choice because I made a decision to just use the terms that both sides of the debate have adopted for themselves.
Okay.
So I refer to those who disagree with me as being pro-choice, and those who agree with me as being pro-life, who believe abortion should be illegal. So I put it in those terms as opposed to calling an opponent pro-abortion, because many of them will snap back and say they're not pro, they don't think abortion is a good thing, they're just for the choice to be able to have one. But I see that really as kind of a difference without a distinction. But my point in using those terms, what each side favors, is to keep the conversation productive. Okay. For example, I don't like it when those who defend legal abortion refer to me as being anti-choice. Because I firmly believe in many choices that don't harm other human beings. Choice isn't the issue at all. The issue is, what is this choice and what does it do? So back, though, to language. I think it's important when we talk about the unborn not to buy into dehumanizing terms like a clump of cells or a potential life or a fertilized egg. Those are all misnomers. They're really inaccurate terms. Though I also might caution that on the pro-life side, when you talk to someone who disagrees, maybe not using emotional rhetoric that makes the person you're talking to get inflamed, such as calling the unborn babies. Now, that's true, but baby is an emotional term. It could even apply to a 24-year-old who goes off to college. They're still their mother's baby. I prefer to try to use just very objective medical terms. I try to use the adjective human whenever possible. So I might say the unborn humans, the human fetus, the human embryo, because that's just undeniable. So putting human in whenever possible is helpful. And then when referring to abortion, I use sometimes just say kill, because abortion is killing. Everyone on both sides of the debate agrees abortion kills something, because otherwise, if it didn't, why would you be using it? So to say things like, should we allow the killing of unborn humans through abortion? That may sound inflammatory, but you can tell the other person, look, this is a neutral way and an objective way to describe what you're talking about. And finally, I think pro-lifers have to be careful. We shouldn't talk about the unborn as if they're not fully human. When we say things like, oh, aren't you excited to be, when we say to a pregnant woman, aren't you excited to be a mother? while forgetting, well, no, she already is a mother right now, and so on and so on. So I think, yes, language is important, and we should be very clear in how we talk about this issue.
Yeah, I think that was one phrase that I never quite picked up on before until I read it in your book, talking about, you're going to be a mother or something. Well, you already are a mother.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very, very good of you to point that out. Now, let's continue on a little bit and talk about what you call the different types. You say you divide what you call the pro-choice advocates, those who are in favor of legal abortion. You divide them into different types of people because, as you point out, and this is any teacher is going to know this, different types of arguments reach different people in different ways, and you have to really know. You have to know who you're in a dispute with, who you're in an argument and a dialogue with, in order to convince them. You got to know the kinds of things that will convince them and won't convince them, and of course, where they're coming from, I think, philosophically. So one of the types you mentioned, in a broad sense, you call them people who avoid the main issue. People who avoid the main issue.
Yeah.
And there's the group I'm interested in. You mentioned the pragmatists, the distractors, as you call them, and also the tolerant. I'm interested in the tolerant, because tolerance is such an abused and overused term in our culture. Tolerance is something we do when we don't like something, so we tolerate it. At least that would be the rightful definition of it. But in the name of tolerance, we're also expected by our culture to put up with all sorts of nonsense, and even, of course, the killing of the unborn. And I wonder if you might speak to that type. Dealing with those who raise up tolerance as probably the virtue.
Yes, tolerance is interesting. People often say, "Oh, it's this kind of virtue," but it really isn't. To tolerate someone simply means you allow them to exist. if I tolerate something, I allow it to actually exist, and it irritates me. If I didn't tolerate it, I wouldn't allow it to bother me. I would somehow try to get rid of it. So certainly when it comes to abortion itself is not very tolerant towards the unborn. Their presence in the womb is not tolerated by those who believe that abortion should be a legal choice. So yeah, these objections, these people who put this argument forward sometimes say, well, it doesn't matter if we disagree about abortion. We don't have to find the right answer or the truth when it comes to abortion. We should just agree to disagree and tolerate each other's opinions. I mean, now that's fine if you're in an argument about the Yankees and the Red Sox or what have you, something like sports or something inconsequential. But when it comes to human beings and their rights and whether they have a right to live or not, that is not something we can agree to disagree about. We have to figure out who is right and who is wrong when it comes to that issue. And so those who disagree about the unborn's right to live, they're free to have their opinion that the unborn are not persons, just as someone may be free to have the opinion that an African American is not a person. But they're not free to act on that opinion as if it were true in the name of tolerance. So we don't allow lynchings of African Americans anymore in the name of tolerance, because we can't tolerate evil in our society. We can't tolerate injustice. And if the unborn are human, we can't tolerate their victimization either. And the problem here is also the tolerant will say, well, the only opposition to abortion is religious, and so you have to tolerate people who are not religious, who have different views. But as I show in the book, there are many good secular arguments in defense of the pro-life view. And so since we can show from reason abortion is wrong, we don't have to tolerate those who think that it's right and allow them to end the lives of unborn children.
Before we talk about a few of those secular reasons, we've touched on that before, I'm wondering, you brought up lynching, and I had already been, there was a question I intended to ask, and I think now is the appropriate time. And that is, what kinds of things ought pro-life advocates to avoid? What kinds of arguments that would be so inflammatory that they shut down the kind of dialogue that you would be hoping for? And I wonder if lynching is not in that group, would something like a comparison to mass killings of other peoples deemed inferior, such as in World War II and the genocide against the Jews by Nazi Germany. Do you think those are appropriate, or did they lose? Is that lose more than it wins?
I think that it depends on the audience you're speaking to. In fact, in my book, I make a point in saying that you should not directly compare what happens in abortion, for example, to what happened in concentration camps in Nazi Germany. One, because many unborn children whose lives are lost through abortion may not have developed to the point where they can feel pain, and many people in concentration camps, you know, felt were tortured brutally before they were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that when we make analogies to acknowledge the disanalogies. What's hard with abortion and pregnancy is that there are very few things in life that are, there's really nothing that's exactly like it to make a perfect analogy. So all analogies will break down. So I do think it's important maybe to shy away in conversations with those who disagree from making comparisons to previous genocides or even things like lynching in some cases. I like to use other modern examples, especially examples that the critic himself agrees with. I remember once I was at a university campus and some students said, oh, well, abortion, should be a woman's choice. It's her body. She should have the right to choose. And I said to these college students, okay, well, let's say there was a company and the president owns this company. Should he have the right to choose to fire his employees if he discovers they act out on same-sex orientation, they engage in same-sex behavior? It's his company. Should he have the right to choose to fire them? And these students were very, these are secular college students, very committed to the, you know, pro-same-sex agenda, would say, oh, well, no, he shouldn't have that choice. And I'll say, well, why not? It's his company, his choice. Well, because that choice hurts other people. And then I say, ah, bingo then. Does the choice to have an abortion, does that hurt or harm the unborn? So if you can pick examples of injustices maybe the person hasn't thought of but can relate to, and then tie them back to abortion, that can be pretty helpful in your conversation.
Do you find college students quite open to your point of view and to listening at least to a debate with an interest in actually arriving at the truth or a willingness to change their minds?
Oh, yeah. I think college students and many other people enjoy thinking through moral issues. And they like especially when you tell them, you give them reasons, not just, oh, well, here's the authority I have that the mm-hmm. church or the Bible says abortion is wrong, therefore it's wrong, you know, which is, there's a truth there. But to be able to show them, hey, there are actually also reasons to explain why the natural law or why the church, you can see through this that abortion is wrong. And they enjoy that you treat them as an adult and say, look, use your minds and think this through rationally, and hopefully you can come to the same conclusion I've come to. And if I'm mistaken, you could always point out to me where my thinking or my reasoning went wrong, though I don't think it has. And I think when they try to point it out, they start to realize the flaw in their own thinking. So when I invite even college students or others to think about the issue and walk through the argument with me, I do find a lot of people open. They may not change their minds immediately because they're emotionally attached to keeping abortion legal, which I think stems really from more of a cultural or a psychological reason than a logical one, because in our culture, abortion is the last resort for someone who engages in sexual activity, especially outside of marriage. If you don't want to have a child, well, abortion is your last chance to stop that from happening. And so I think many people will want to defend abortion even if they don't have a good argument, because they want it to be legal. And so sometimes we have to confront that issue in the heart before the argument can be successful.
So your book does talk about the difference between, or the important distinction we ought to draw between changing a culture through argumentation and the convincing of the mind through reason, the intellect, and the heart, as opposed to changes in law. That is, coercive laws. But I wonder, there's a lot of things we do outlaw in our society, including theft, including various types of pornography, murder of those who have been born, certainly. These are all outlawed. At what point is it not despair to give up on changing the culture, and we're trying to save human beings, so shouldn't we push for just the outlawing of abortion in all cases? And sure, it would be nice to change the culture first, so then the laws would come later. But can't laws also change culture by forcing a certain behavior?
Yes, law can act as a teacher. And in some cases, like we saw with the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the changing of laws did change many people's attitudes, though culture still had a long way to go. What I worry about is that unlike other previous injustices, such as injustices that afflicted during the civil rights movement, the victims are very hidden from our culture. So the unborn can't march in the street demanding justice. And so when the issue of abortion comes up, our culture, when they think of the issue, they think of women, and they think of women going to abortion facilities. And it makes them more reticent to want to outlaw abortion because they worry about harming those women. They identify with those choosing abortion rather than those who are aborted. I also worry that if we continue to try to outlaw abortion entirely when the culture doesn't want that, there'll be kind of more antagonism and resistance to the pro-life movement as a whole. Whereas I think that possibly incrementally, similar to how the animal rights movement has gained a lot of traction, you start with the most cuddly animals first and then move to the others, we might be able to make headway in that regard. But I'm very concerned about simply trying to go for the 99-yard touchdown instead of a few lateral plays to get to the end goal. Because in the society we live in, if a law is rejected, if the majority of people don't want something to be illegal, it generally won't be. Though I do think, though, if we can start, and say, hey, let's just try to ban abortions after the first trimester, you could get the majority of people will agree on that point. And then slowly, if it's whittled away, then they may see, oh, wait a minute, there's really no point in having these distinctions at all. So I do think that there's a balance. The laws do affect the culture, but the culture affects the laws a lot. So we really have to still be working on that as well.
Now, if the goal then is to persuade, is that what makes dialogue with compassion compassionate? We're not only compassionate for the babies we're trying to save, we're compassionate towards this person we're arguing with, whom we're also trying to save, aren't we?
Right.
By reorienting their heart and mind to the truth of God and the truth of what the human person is and all that entails. Do you find that in these disputes you're also leading people into the church? Do you have any cases of kind of a raging secularist who, this is what did it? Once they realize the unborn or living human persons who deserve life like everybody else, this kind of led them the rest of the way?
Yeah, no, when I've talked on college campuses and with others, even on the radio, I find that they're impressed with the logic behind my position and also just the care and the care for the intrinsic dignity of all human beings. And that naturally leads to the question, well, why should we think that all human beings have this immaterial quality of intrinsic dignity? I mean, in a naturalistic universe where life evolves randomly and accidentally, these qualities like dignity or intrinsic value, they don't seem to really fit in a naturalistic universe. In fact, there's a famous philosopher named, a contemporary philosopher, Steven Pinker, who I think he wrote an essay called The Stupidity of Dignity, or it was called The Uselessness of Dignity. But I think most people resonate, well, no, dignity and value, just not because of what you can do, but because of what you are, because of who you are, that really does matter. And I tell others, I think this makes sense in my Catholic worldview, that God created the world, he loves human beings, and he made all of us equal in dignity, so that while we differ in things like our functional abilities, that doesn't mean some of us have more rights to live, for example, than anyone else. We should all be treated as equals, and people really resonate with that equality that I think can only be found in a Christian or, you know, Catholic worldview.
This is Dr. John Pinheiro, and you're listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. Today I'm interviewing Trent Horn about the topic of his new book, which is entitled Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue. And that toughest issue, according to Mr. Horn, is abortion. And so we've been talking for about the last half hour about how to engage in compassionate dialogue with those who are in some way in favor of legalized abortion. And Trent, what this reminds me of is a couple things. One is what you're really talking about here in terms of dialogue is good old-fashioned Socratic dialogue, the oldest and best teaching method in the world. But also the Dominican tradition of disputatio, which our new philosopher at Aquinas College here resurrected recently at our college. And their first topic was to debate the dropping of the atomic bomb. Talk about innocent lives and utilitarian arguments for subordinating those innocent lives for other people's lives and the whole complexity there. And so we had two people come to our campus, two philosophers from Notre Dame, who debated that. And I had to miss it. I was somewhere else. I can't remember. I think I was taking students to Rome or something. So I can't.
Oh, wow.
I can't complain about having missed it. But it's a fabulous event. We hope to have more. And that leads me thinking about not only the great Dominican Thomas Aquinas, who what you were saying earlier was reminiscent of that when you talked about not arguing from authority. Thomas said authority is the weakest of all arguments. He always included it.
So says Boethius.
Yeah. And Boethius, and isn't that true? Huh?
Yeah. Yes. No. It is the weakest of them to argue from authority. I think in Latin it's argumentum veracundium. That so and so says X, so X is true. Sometimes that is correct. If the authority is recognized.
It does make it easy, right? So for those of us who are working 12 hours a day, if Bishop so-and-so or a group of philosophers says something, I'm going to be inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt, I would think. Now, if that's the case, then what are we to do then with groups like Catholics for Choice or Catholics who are very open about their pro-choice position? So we're not talking then necessarily about those whom Orestes Brownson called political atheists, that is those who claim they believe abortion is the killing of a human being, but in their actions and voting behaviors, they act as if that doesn't matter. You know, this is the old, I'm personally opposed, but I don't want to limit anybody else. I'm talking about groups like Catholics for Choice. At what point is it compassionate to declare them excommunicated by their own actions?
Well, the Code of Canon Law, I think it's Canon 915, I can't remember which one, talks about how scandal can lead to excommunication in this regard. And I will say this, that what they're doing is certainly a grave disservice on two fronts. One, if you recognize the authority of the Catholic Church, the Church has adamant that abortion is a grave evil and a grave sin. And this has been put forward bluntly in magisterial documents. It has been taught uniformly since the first century, since the earliest documents we have, and even up through Pope John Paul II's great encyclical, The Gospel of Life. He almost stopped just short of exercising papal infallibility, but he says, I declare as a successor of Peter in union with the bishops and a doctrine that has been taught uniformly that abortion is direct abortion is a grave evil. And it's very clear in all the magisterial documents and groups like Catholics for Choice twist what they say, and I expose some of that in my book. What they'll often do is they'll say, well, they'll appeal to writings on conscience. Oh, well, your conscience guides you, and you have to obey your conscience, and they'll twist the Church's teaching on conscience. Because, yes, you should obey your conscience when properly formed, but you should never obey your conscience when it tells you to do something intrinsically evil. And a great rejoinder to people like Catholics for Choice who say you should always follow your conscience, I like to ask them, okay, my conscience tells me that abortion is a grave evil and I should make it illegal. So should I follow my conscience to make abortion illegal? And so now they're trapped in a dilemma, obviously. If they say yes, they don't want me to make it illegal. And if they say no, then conscience is not their highest authority. So I think you can walk them through the magisterial documents to show that Catholics know this is wrong. But even aside from that, when we use the tools of human reason, when we just use our minds without reflecting on divine revelation, it's just very clear the unborn are human beings and we should protect them. Even an atheist can see that. So I think on both of those fronts is how we can respond. But I have a whole chapter in my book dedicated to responding to the arguments of religious people who believe that abortion should be legal.
Would you say that's a large group? I mean, is that a large part of the very active pro-choice, or is that establishment, or is that group of religious pro-choicers more of, I guess, for lack of a better word, maybe just kind of apathetic, ambivalent. In other words,
yeah.
They're not really actively pro-choice. They just are. They're not the greatest opponents of the pro-life movement.
Sure. I think that the majority of those who argue for legal abortion, those in the professional movement in the pro-choice world, don't use religious arguments too much. They appeal to things like women's health or tolerance for different religious viewpoints. They're a pretty big player in some areas, but in general, you'll just see people like Planned Parenthood, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, using their standard arguments from health and women's rights, and they play a little bit of a role, the religious end. I would say, though, of course, the majority of people who support legal abortion, since most people in our country are at least vaguely religious, they might believe in God or spirituality, most people who are pro-choice probably believe in some vague religious concept. Oftentimes you'll hear them say things like this: well, God gave us free will, he gave us choice, so we should respect that. But of course, God gave us the free will to, you know, burn down our parents' home to collect the insurance money. That doesn't mean it's moral to do that. Or people say, well, God, this is just between a woman or God, or God will forgive me later. And well, we shouldn't hurt other people presuming that God will just forgive us later, because in Proverbs 6:16, the Bible is clear that God hates the shedding of innocent blood. Now, anyone who's been involved in an abortion procedure and is truly repentant and is sorrowful over having done this, God will lovingly embrace them and blot out their sin and give them healing and hope. And so anyone who's been involved in this should seek the sacrament, especially the sacrament of reconciliation, to know that God loves them and wants to heal them from this suffering. But that should not be used to presumptively say, oh, well, God will understand what I'm going to do, because God doesn't tolerate the killing of the innocent.
Yeah, that's like that old, I think, misunderstood phrase by Martin Luther when he talked about sinning boldly, you know, because you're going to be forgiven. And I don't think he meant it quite the way some might think he did,
right.
but nevertheless, a misunderstanding of things, particularly conscience, I think. We were talking about conscience a minute ago. If there's anything that came out of in the wake of the Second Vatican Council that was very misunderstood, maybe outside the liturgy, it would be this idea of conscience and how it doesn't simply mean the will to power, but that's
right.
How it's been interpreted even by Catholics.
And I think that there, there's a great example is to bring up to show even the other side admits there are some things you should not follow your conscience on, like trying to make abortion illegal, or trying to defend in the law the definition of marriage as the union of a man and a woman. They'll say there, oh, well, hold on, you can't follow your conscience, it's just wrong, buddy. Oh, well, okay, so now you're appealing to a standard beyond conscience. Mm-hmm. And so we have to show them that we have this standard also, and that when their consciences tell them that abortion is moral, their consciences are simply in error.
You have one section of your book, Persuasive Pro-Life, that's called People with Tough Questions. And we have about 12, 13 minutes left in the program here. And I'd like to get to this, because the tough questions, we call them tough because they're tough to answer, and because there's probably some element of truth, of course, in what the other side is saying when they ask these tough questions. So I wondered if you might take us through one or two of these tough questions and how you deal with them. Think of the toughest questions you get, and they're coming from not somebody who just wants to win the argument on points, like a public debate where people clap for each side and we engage in ad hominem and whatever it takes to win. But these are people who probably can't be persuaded, but for well-meaning reasons, they ask these very tough questions.
Yes, I would say the two most common would be one, well, what if a woman's life is in danger? Mm-hmm. And there, what's tough about it is that we understand, you could say the child is alive, the mother is alive, they're both human beings. What do we do then if someone's life is being threatened due to circumstances related to another person's life? And what I would say there is that it is acceptable to, in pregnancy, treat whatever the disease or the problem is that is threatening the woman's life, to kill disease and to kill maladies or pathologies, but not to kill unborn children, because they're not pathologies. They're another patient who's involved in all of this. So we can, for example, in an ectopic pregnancy, remove the damaged section of the fallopian tube that is causing the serious problem, foreseeing that the child's life will be ended, and knowing we can't, there's no way we can save him, foreseeing it without intending it. And of course, that gets into the great Catholic doctrine of double effect. But just to make it simple for people to say that we should kill disease and kill pathologies, and if a child dies unintentionally, that's sad, but it's morally acceptable. But it's not acceptable to directly kill one person in order to help another person. I think the other, though, tough question most pro-lifers receive is, what about abortion in the case of rape? And I like that you brought up that there's an element of truth in some of these questions. And here, I think the element of truth is that regardless of what option is chosen when a pregnancy results from rape, it's just there's no good option out of the situation. There's still the trauma of the rape. Nothing can ever undo that. And so we're stuck in a really bad situation. So we can say, look, there's all these options that are not ideal, but there's some that should be taken off the table. For example, we know rape is wrong because it's an act of violence against an innocent person. And we shouldn't blame the woman who's a victim of something that is completely not her fault. Likewise, though, the child who's conceived in rape is also blameless, and it's not their fault how they were conceived. So we should treat both mother and child equally and provide both with nonviolent assistance, and we should punish the person who's truly responsible, who's the rapist, and understand that this is just going to be difficult. We know it's awful, but the problem is there's no way to undo the rape or undo that a child was created. All we can do is try to provide the best support we can for the mother and child and bring the attacker to justice. So in these tough questions, we need to empathize with the other person to show where their concerns are valid, but show how violence against an innocent person is simply not a good solution to these difficult problems.
Now, isn't a tough question also the one that says something like this? If you outlaw most abortions, or at least make it difficult, or you make it difficult in one particular state, or a nation like Ireland or Poland has outlawed abortion, what won't that drive women to engage in the so-called back alley dangerous abortion?
Yeah, and the way to answer this is to look at it from two angles, the moral argument and the factual argument. From the moral argument, I think it's very simple to show this objection doesn't work very well. It's simply saying that if we make it illegal for bigger people to kill smaller people, it'll be more dangerous for the bigger people. So we should keep that kind of killing legal. Now, when you describe it in those terms, the argument seems pretty poor. We don't keep killing legal just so it's safer for the perpetrator. We don't make crime legal so it's safer for the criminal. So if the unborn are human beings, we can't keep it, we can't keep abortion legal so that it's safe, because it's never safe for them. It's designed to end their life. So from a moral perspective, we can show that the unborn are human. This argument simply assumes they're not human without actually arguing it. And then the second point is we can show that the factual argument that that women's health will deteriorate and there'll be these bad consequences is simply not true. For example, in Ireland and Poland, where abortion is generally illegal, the maternal mortality rates, or the rates of pregnant women who die, is actually lower than it is in the United States, which has essentially abortion on demand. So that's simply just not the case. And former pro-choice advocates like Bernard Nathanson, who passed away some time ago, he even admitted in his book Aborting America, when he made abortion legal, when he lobbied for it, they lied. They made up the numbers of people who were dying from back alley abortions. They did whatever they could to get the laws passed, and those lies have been with us to this very day. So if we can respond to the moral and factual parts of this objection, I think we can easily show it's not sound.
Well, I appreciate your multifaceted approach to this. I mean, your Persuasive Pro-Life really is an excellent book. It was a very good read, very organized, which I like. I like a good organized book or organized essay, and I don't like to have to puzzle through things that shouldn't be puzzled through. And any good philosophical thinker is supposed to bring clarity, not further obscure the issue. And I think you do that in the book, and I appreciate that. In our closing moments here, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the resources we might find in the Catholic intellectual tradition. On Faith and Reason, that's our main emphasis. And from time to time, sure, we do have apologists on the program, and we talk about the abortion issue. But in general, we have a lot of poets and writers and scholars and others, and we talk about our great gift to the world. One of our great gifts to the world as Catholics are our intellectual and moral traditions. And so I'm wondering, other than St. John Paul II, who wrote so wonderfully about this, so wonderfully it was even incorporated into later editions of the Catechism, but who else would we want to turn to, not to help us out with our rhetorical skills and how to argue, which is what you do, but just to help us think more deeply on issues like conscience and authority and everything that goes into your, I guess I would say, your arsenal for arguing.
Sure. Well, I guess what I would say when it comes to moral issues and thinking clearly on that, and also being able to and address the issue of abortion among that, one book that I enjoy reading and recommending to others is a book by a moral theologian named William May called Catholic Bioethics and the Gift of Life. And so that's a nice contemporary read for people to help understand Catholic bioethics and the natural law principles inherent in them to help us sift through these difficult issues. I also think for the more advanced readers who want to go back to the source, I think they can read St. Thomas Aquinas's commentaries on different ethical questions to see what he thought about subjects like the principle of double effect and the morality of acts, what makes an act moral or immoral. And finding that in his writings, I think, is an invaluable aid to learning how to think clearly. Finally, on this particular issue, on the issue of abortion, there are several Catholic philosophers that have written higher-level books on the subject that are very, very good. In fact, the reason I wrote my book, I quote from them with fair frequency in the book, or I allude to their arguments. I tried to write my book so lay people could be introduced to some of their work that's a bit higher up, but I still recommend. And those would be people like Patrick Lee at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, who has a book called Abortion and Unborn Human Life. Francis Beckwith has a great book called Defending Life. And Christopher Cazor has a wonderful book called The Ethics of Abortion that hail from that very analytic and well-thought-out Catholic tradition that also would appeal to a secular audience.
Thank you very much for those recommendations. I noticed one person who didn't make the list, and I can't help but we're going to have to talk about the late Cardinal Bernardin here.
He's in the book.
He's in the book, and I'm sure our listeners would appreciate your point of view. Because what you did for me was, I guess you helped me realize what had bothered me, but I didn't know how to put it into words or describe it, about using the seamless garment argument, as he put it. Which on the one hand, you know, it's true in a sense, but you list him, I think if I recall, as one of our unhelpful allies.
Yes, that's the idea that some Catholics will say we shouldn't focus our efforts so much on abortion, we should focus on other life issues too, like euthanasia and capital punishment. And now it's true we should hold all of those lives as being equally valuable. But I actually quote from Cardinal Bernardine in the book a later speech he gave where he clarified his own remarks and said, we don't have to approach the issues equally. Mm. I mean, the fact of the matter is someone who says we should have the same efforts going against capital punishment as we do against abortion is just flat out wrong about the gravity of each situation. I mean, more people will die from abortion by lunchtime today. Just by abortion alone, then have been killed by by capital punishment since it was reinstated in the 1970s. So, I mean, that when we have abortions happening over 1 million a year in the United States compared to these other issues, we're more than justified in marshaling our resources to this greater tragedy, but without saying that other lives simply don't count.
So we have to be careful in the way we say this. I'm not as knowledgeable about this aspect of the Catholic tradition as I should be, but there certainly is a longer tradition of Catholics living in a state that practice capital punishment and drawing a distinction between the innocent and the guilty, etc. Than there is just, of course, there's no tradition of outright approval of the killing of the innocent, whether they're civilian peasants during warfare in the Middle Ages or anyone else.
And that brings us back to another important distinction to say, now hold on a minute, one of these is something that is evil by degree. Capital punishment is not intrinsically evil. It's evil in certain circumstances, whereas abortion or euthanasia is an intrinsic evil. It's an evil you can never justify. And when we do lump them together, we sometimes lose that distinction, which can be very dangerous. We forget that abortion is intrinsically evil. We start to think some circumstances it could be okay when it just can't be.
This is Dr. John Panero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason. Trent Horn, I want to thank you very much for being on a program today. You've taken us on a fascinating tour through the topics in your new book, Persuasive Pro-Life. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I know I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have too.
Yes, no, I've been very glad to speak with you today. And if your listeners want to learn more about what's in my book, they can pick up a copy of it at the book's website, which is persuasiveprolife.com, or they can visit Catholic Answers at shop.catholic.com. But the easiest way to get the book would probably be persuasiveprolife.com.
Okay. Now, when they go to your other website, do you have kind of a Q&A list that can help them out on the web, or are they going to have to buy the book?
Oh, well, I have some resources there, and there is a sample chapter that they can download to look at, just to get a feeling inside the book and see what it covers. But the book is available both in paperback, and also if they want a cheaper option, there's also an ebook version.
Oh, how about that? Okay. Great. Now, I asked that question as somebody who's always trying to hawk my book, even in line at the grocery store. So please understand. Well, Trent, it's been great having you on Faith and Reason today. And dear listener, I want to wish you a good afternoon. For episodes of Faith and Reason, you can turn to our webpage where this show, once it airs, will be archived. But all of our past shows are archived there, too, at holyfamilyradio.net. Thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is a professor of history and director of Catholic studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.